Hey everyone, welcome to the Talking Split podcast. I am Rob Calder, the Coach Development Officer at Basketball Victoria. With me, I have Mike Zeppel, the High Performance Coach for Vic Metro. How are you, Mike?
Robbie, I am good, mate. It's just you and me today, which means ratings bonanza.
It's usually how it works. So we're on episode 27 this week. Robbie, what have you got for me?
Robbie, the 27s. Listen to this list. You would think number 27... not many very good ads. It's kind of a weird number. When you get to 30, 31, 32, you can see some studs coming through. But the list here is interesting, mate. Craig Starcevich, number 27. At the moment, Glenn Jakovich was a really good 27 for the West Coast Eagles.
Steve Alessio doesn't feature here, mate. I'm going to be disappointed.
Well, two times Essendon, mate. Simon Madden and Steve Alessio both were number 27.
Very good.
Matty Stokes was a champion, number 27 for the Geelong Footy Club. Overseas, Vladimir Guerrero, you're a big Major League Baseball fan, so I know you would know that he had a very good
household name.
Major League career, did Vlad. And in the NBA, listen to this collection of dudes. Zaza Pachulia, rocking the number 27. Jamal Murray, who's he's a pretty good player. Denver Nuggets. And Jordan Crawford, who has bounced around the league, you would say.
Not his best final series just recently.
Mr. Crawford. So they're the 27s, mate.
Excellent. Same as every week. This comes out on a Friday. If you can please like, share, review the podcast, all those sorts of things online would be fantastic. Have had a couple of extra ones during the week, which is great. We do appreciate it. But anything to help grow the podcast audience would be fantastic. Absolutely. We are one man short again. This is not the first time it's happened.
No.
I might just start playing the music as we go through this. So,
decent reason this time.
There is. This is at least acceptable. So Justin is overseas coaching the under-17 Australian men, the Crocs. He is off to Argentina. So we thought we'd
South America
educate our fan base, if you could call it a fan base,
absolutely,
or just our listenership,
yeah,
with some fun facts about Argentina.
What do you got, Robbie?
Capital of Argentina, Buenos Aires.
Very good.
That's a great place. Mm-hmm. Lots of languages they speak in Argentina. Italian, French, English, German. Oh. So Justin will fit right in there.
Interesting.
Like he's got that covered.
Like a local, maybe.
He is. He'll be revered. The local currency is the peso.
Interesting.
It is.
Interesting.
You got anything there?
They're pretty standard facts on Argentina, Robbie. The real facts on Argentina are that it's got the highest divorce rate in the world. That's an interesting Argentinian fact right there. This is even more interesting, Robbie. 1 in 30 Argentinians have undergone some form of cosmetic surgery, so maybe some Botox for the great man on return.
He'll come back with a shredded six-pack or something like that?
Who knows, right? Who knows? This is interesting, too. It's the third largest producer of beef in the world, Robbie.
You know what would suck, though? Is if you were a vegetarian, for argument's sake, and you go to Argentina,
what would you do? The lentil shepherd pie is not on the menu. in Argentina. The home of barbecue, they call it. The tango originated in Argentina. Okay, our great man can dance a little bit. And there's this sport over there, pato or peito. I'm not sure how you pronounce it, mate. It's one of those languages, which is a bit of a cross between polo, basketball, and kiddich. And they used to use a live duck as the ball, Robbie. So it's on Fox Sports 2 tonight at 9:30.
Have ESPN the Ocho contact that and we'll be okay. So
Carton.
We haven't got too much from Justin yet. He just arrived in Chile today. So we're yet to find out how his results are going or his practice games or anything like that. But we'll keep you guys posted,
we'll report
obviously.
Back.
I think most of the games are usually live streamed on the FIBA YouTube channel as well. So I'm not sure what the time difference is. But if you want to go and have a look, you can normally get the games the next day, if nothing else anyway. So best of luck to the great man, Justin Shaw, over there. He will be missed. Not by us, but he will be missed. So we do have another guest on this week.
Great guest this week,
Robbie. Dr. Julia Walsh from Deakin University is going to come in and talk things, all things coaching. She is the senior lecturer in sports coaching at Deakin. So wealth of knowledge. And we'll get started with Julia now. Welcome back, everyone. We are here with our special guest, Dr. Julia Walsh, who is the senior lecturer in sports coaching at Deakin University. Welcome, Julia.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
It's fantastic to have you on. Mike and I were talking in the office a couple of weeks ago about we need a guest, and we need a good guest, and we need someone that's smarter than both of us. And the first person we thought of was not Justin Shuler, it was you. So we have got you in, and we're about to have you here.
Outdone ourselves, Robbie. Yeah, well, we got rid of Justin too, so the intelligence in the room is significantly...
Well, I'm going to have to live up to something here.
We set a very low bar, we'll be fine, so you won't have any problems jumping over that. But probably first off, how did you get involved with basketball to start off with? So, I mean, everyone's got a different story to tell, obviously, okay. But where did it begin for you?
My story is that I had three brothers that were playing basketball, and I used to go and hang out there and watch them play at Bulling Templestowe Basketball Club. Mm-hmm. And all I wanted to do was play, but there were actually no teams at that stage for me, so that gives you some sense of how old I am. And then the only pathway for me actually was to go in as a referee. And even that was blocked initially for women until my mother, the feminist, who doesn't know she's a feminist, went and complained about this to the council. And a certain club was told that they wouldn't get any more finances unless they made sure that women had a pathway in coaching. So in refereeing. So I got to referee. Then I actually went across to play with the Melbourne Telstars. Mm-hmm. So I spent my sort of, I started really playing at 14 years of age, and I stayed with that club. But so I played for a number of years, but then I got into coaching. I just wanted to coach. That was what I could see. But in that pathway too, there was no specialist coaching courses. But so I had to become a teacher. Yep. That was all right, because I, as a phys ed teacher, I got to coach every single day and after hours. And really, my basketball coaching was like five nights a week, every weekend. For anyone that's coaching and in that space, you'd understand that. And I stayed doing that until I found this course that was a master's in sport coaching. It was the only one offered in the Western world in English. And I saved up my money and I went across to Canada and I did this course in coaching there and came back and resumed my work, which with Melbourne Telstars, that had now become Melbourne Tigers, with Ray Tomlinson, and it was an establishing club.
Mm.
So I got to coach, sometimes I coached five teams in a night, depending on whether Ray was out with a national team or this, that and the other. And I even got to coach with the women's team and play in that space. So I was very fortunate that I ended up with someone like that club and Ray Tomlinson to be mentored in coaching. So that was that transition, I suppose, from playing to coaching. And I just stayed in that space of coaching, went back to Bulling Templestowe Basketball Club as a coaching coordinator, was a coaching coordinator at Sandringham, coached several state women's teams as an assistant coach. So I got experience with other coaches as well. And at one stage, I was working at a TAFE. And at this TAFE,
How did you have time for that?
Because I'll tell you what, you also have to have the second job that allows you to coach. So that was my paid job that allowed me to coach. And in this TAFE position, I had to supervise a class that was coaching athletes with disabilities. And I thought, well, if I'm going to have to sit here and supervise it, I may as well do this. And with that, I chose the group to go and do my practice with, the ones that I thought scares me the most, because I don't know how to work in this space. So I went and worked with this, with Powerhouse and with the athletes with an intellectual disability, because it was the challenge for me is I don't know anything about this space, so how do I work in this space? So I ended up doing that as well. Well, what a lesson. They taught me more about coaching than any other group I'd ever had. They challenged my problem solving.
Mm.
They told me how to coach at times. And I continue to be challenged in a really good way with that group. And, you know, I'm working in the 3-on-3 space and all of that, but I think we're going to cover some of that. So that's my story in a nutshell.
Basketball lifer, you would call that, Robbie. Absolutely. That is exactly what you call that.
And we need them in our sport, in all honesty, and we have a few of them around the place.
Absolutely.
But it's interesting you say that it challenged you to be a better coach. Well, in that way, because I certainly find it now. I coach under 18s for probably the last 3 or 4 years, and it's really easy for me to flippantly walk into a training session and just say, hey, we're in Boston drill, five times up and down, and we're okay. And my attention to detail was poor. My communication skills were poor. And now I've gone back to coaching under 12s. And unless I give them the exact details of what I need, it doesn't get remotely close to done. So it's really interesting to hear you say that, because I think at times we can get lost in that we coach the older age group kids and the really talented athletes, and it's really easy to forget about not the lower levels as such, but the base and the grassroots as to where it actually starts. It's such a different world having to go back into that.
And some of that's too about embedded language.
Yep.
So you talked about the Boston drill.
Yep.
Now your players will know that there are probably 12 or 15 really important teaching points in that.
Yep.
And you can decide where you're going to place the emphasis, and you may even just say to them, hand, and that means that they're going to collapse into a position, this, that, like several things will change if you use that language. But you go down to the under 12s and say, we're going to run Boston.
Yep.
Or we're going to do this, and they think, what?
Yep.
And it's the same with the groups of athletes with an intellectual disability. You walk in and you think, I can do all of this normally. And I'll tell you a little story about that, where I went into one group and I brought my board every week and I showed them what they were going to do. And one day one of them said, you know that board thing? None of us understand it. Now, I can tell you that none of my other teams have ever said that to me. And I thought, that's great, because now I have to coach differently because you don't understand anything I'm doing.
Yeah, and that might have been the case in previous years, but you just didn't know.
No, because there is a, if I say that, the coach might think I don't know anything.
Absolutely. And there's that old adage that it's not how much you know, it's about how much the people you're trying to teach in the classroom, on the court, can actually understand. So you can be the rocket scientist to yourself, but if your athletes do not understand anything, it's about what they can take.
That's right.
Which is obviously something we've spoken about previously. You started off in the intellectually disabled space many years ago and still working in that space right now with Victorian Ivor Burge teams. And do you want to talk a little bit into your current involvement?
I haven't been with the Ivor Burge team at South Victorian team for 2 years because you have 3 years and then you rotate it, which I think is a great idea, or else we have the same people staying in the place forever. But I have a long history in that space.
7 gold medals, Mike.
That's a lot.
It's more than I have. It's more than you have. It's a pretty esteemed record right there, which is fantastic.
Yeah, but I'll tell you something, though, that the medal that means the most to me actually is the silver one, because the silver one made me a gold medal coach.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So do you want to elaborate a little bit more on that?
Yeah, I think I made a lot of mistakes in that competition. And there was one, you know, that belief where you got the three-point player and think, yeah, he always shoots 3 points. They're going to come down. They're going to come down.
Mm-hmm.
36, he had, this is how I can remember it, he had 36 shots of 3 points in that game.
Mm-hmm.
And we lost. And I needed to say after three, step in.
Mm-hmm.
It's not happening for you.
Yeah, Justin Shuler type numbers, right?
Yeah. Or this, that, and the other, because it's not going to happen. And I think you learn that with experience.
Yep.
You learn that actually, if it's not happening now, you're going to have to change something.
Yep.
And you have to make those decisions faster. You don't want to, as soon as they make a mistake, you don't want to take them off. You want to give them a chance, but then you want to give them a come in, closer, take the shot, or send it round again before you get it and take that shot again. Or I think I need to sub and try something different.
Mm.
But that never happened again.
Yeah. And self-reflection.
That's the learning.
Like
absolutely.
And that's a huge part. I know we spoke about this too. Like John Wooden didn't win a national championship his first like 17 years at UCLA, which is incredible, because he could have been fired after the 15th year and then he wouldn't have won 10 of his next 11, which is interesting just how all of a sudden something clicks.
Yep.
And whatever clicks and self-reflection, and then I think also just the continuous self-growth as well. Like you get better the longer you stick with it and you evolve your philosophies and you evolve what you think about the game and your communication, and that's obviously something that experience drove that for you.
Yeah, and I think also the other main point with that experience is you learn to listen. So when the athletes, and I've done it with my Ivor Burge athletes, we were running a press break and they said it's not working in practice, I said, where is it working? What would you change?
Mm.
Okay, let's test it. Let's keep working on it till they got what they thought worked.
Yeah.
Hey, that's fine. We got a solution together. And that's not detrimental to me as a coach, but it gives voice to them, and they've got good voice. They're the ones playing it, not me. Absolutely. So being able to listen and work with your players to actually get a better outcome.
Yep. And when it's player driven and there's some ownership on that, it's always going to go a little better. And that's the adaptability part of coaching that we talk about a fair bit. You can't walk in pig-headed and go, no, we're going to stick with this until we have this right. If it's not working for your players, you need to sit there and listen, get input from them. And okay, there might be times where you say, no, it has to be this. But if they have ownership and they have a say and they have a little bit of input into it, there's going to be so much more buy-in. And it's so vital at the younger age groups or working with athletes with a disability. If they don't feel a part of it, they're not going to play.
And I'd say that, you know, that's what I'm doing with this group. But I bet if I went and watched Sandy Bondello or any of our Australian coaches, I bet that's what they're doing.
They're listening to their
coaches and listening to their players and working out how you can work together to get the outcome you need.
Yeah, and if you think about it at the very, very pointy end, like you've got Brad Stevens, who's 6 foot, played Division III basketball. And Roy Williams didn't play college basketball. Tom Izzo did not play college basketball. They would know very early on that they're dealing with 6'9", 6'10", 6'11", athletic, bouncy, long arms, that what they see is definitely not going to be what the 6'9", 6'10", 6'11" athlete sees. So in their teaching, that would have been, they've taken 20, 30 years of knowledge and learnings from every athlete they've coached to ultimately build to where they are today. So I think that's, listening is obviously critical.
Well, and the understanding part is really vital too. Like, I know I have this conversation with some of our point guards at the senior level. It's like, hey, you're not doing this, this, and this, but we need that. And they're like, well, there's a reason. Like, I see this, this, and this when they're playing. It's like, well, okay, this is different. So playing eyes versus coaching eyes can be really different. I sit there and I see them hard showing on an on-ball screen. They say, they're not hard showing on that. They're trapping me off that. Like, it's just a different look. But I don't experience that because I have time and space, and I'm not the one having my skill base tested. It's such a different world out there. But I think that communication between the players and the coaching staff will make so many teams better when we can get that. So you're also head coach now, recently appointed at the Australian Boomerangs, which is a fantastic achievement for yourself and great recognition for the work you've done as well. What does your campaign schedule look like now? So you've only been appointed a couple of months ago,
That's right. Yeah. My campaign. My campaign, actually, this Saturday we have a planning day. Awesome. So we'll have a planning day where all my assistant coach, my performance analyst, and my manager will be there. And my starting point is, how many hours have I got?
Yep.
Right, I reckon I've got somewhere between probably 36 and 40 hours to prepare that team.
Yep.
So I've got to think about what the big rocks are that we can change.
Mm.
And then with that, the first thing, I'll take you through what we're going to do. This is what my agenda is. So I hope you're all listening out there, anyone that's turning up to this meeting. So my performance analyst has actually gone through the 12 games that we could get film of, and she's done the full full coding of all those games. So she will report on all of that. Then we actually have done questionnaires with every one of the players, actually trying to find out not only what, there's some information there that anyone would ask, but I also want to know what their perceptions are and what reality is. So I've asked them questions about, what position do you think you play best at? What do you normally play? And then I've done the shooting as well. Where do you prefer to shoot from? Where does it go in?
Yeah.
I can tell you straight away they're different places, and I think I may as well just run horns for the rest of the but I'm much more open than that.
Coach, I'm good when I'm open.
And then our next step is to actually ask, have we missed anyone? So that's our first stage of making sure that we understand the players, we understand the competition, we know that we've got all the players that we need to select from. To now actually sit down and say, and the other thing is, I've got reports from some other coaches about style of play that's typically run. There's no good us investing all of our time in a man-to-man offense when most of them play zone.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to look at, how do we best use that 40 hours with these players? So that's the first half of the day. And then the second half of the day, we'll sit there and then we'll sort of, I think, start to nut out, where do we think with those big rocks we are best to make our decisions, and then who's going to take responsibility for that, and let's really look at the communication and the breakdown of that. Now let's put that into camp, and then with all of that too, we'll map out that whole year Okay, so where are we going to have those camps? Where are we going to have that training? That's the manager's job. Camps, and then what does that look like for the championship for that program? Our challenge with any of these programs is the individuals. And I did ask all of my athletes about how many are you engaging in strength training and mobility work and all of that. So what I'm seeing is that's a big rock for us, because not many of them have invested any time in that. And most are playing once or twice a week. And there's a whole lot of work to be done there. But I need to get some satellite coaches. I need some people that would actually say, I will actually, you know, work with that player in this state for an hour every week, or 2 hours every week. That'd be so huge for us in being prepared and ready for that competition that takes place in October next year in Brisbane, if you're around.
That's called a call to action, Robbie. Yep. So if somebody out there, anybody out there, is open, putting their hand up to potentially helping some of Julia's athletes out, definitely get in touch get in touch with the pod if you want to. If you run small group stuff and have a chance to get them involved, and
they can come and join your groups too. Would be surprised at the athleticism with these kids. All right, with this group that I'm working with, if I walked into a stadium, you wouldn't pick up anything. These are great athletes.
That's fantastic. Well, yeah, absolutely. Anyone that is interested in helping out, by all means, get in touch with us, and we'll put you in touch with Julia as well. I think that'd be a fantastic way. It's a great way for coaches to get involved, and also get a little bit of learning, as you said. Yeah. Like, you got the most development you've had dealing with athletes with an intellectual disability. Just, it can help your own coaching a long way as well. Like, it's a great space to get into, I think, for a lot of coaches, and.
It'll extend your coaching.
It will.
And we hear these stories from swimming, from a whole lot of other areas where we've seen that satellite type program really develop.
Yep, absolutely. So what's the end goal for your Boomerang? So when's your globals? So
when are they? October in Brisbane. So we're on home soil, so it's always nice.
Beautiful.
Very good.
In October next year.
Excellent.
Yeah. Look, at this level, we are aiming to medal. That's what we need to do.
Yep.
What colour it is, well, I'll keep that to myself at the moment. That's what I'll be aiming at.
Yep.
But we would aim to medal. And look, this is a high performance team, and we would expect no less of a high performance program than we would with any other group.
Yep.
You know, accountability from everyone that's involved, and I think when people walk in knowing that, there is a totally different approach to just coming and saying, "Oh, look, we're just getting together to do this and achieve this." So absolutely, it is a high performance program.
Absolutely. And anyone that's interested in getting involved in that pathway as well, by all means reach out, and we can put you in touch with Julia or the guys at BA or whoever we need to, because it is a fantastic pathway as well. Like, if you go and watch some of the basketball at the Ivor Burrs Championships that are held with the under-20s, you wouldn't know that that's not mainstream basketball at the time. Like, they are fantastic athletes. There's a Victorian guy, Jake, who is astounding.
He has got to be. I don't know that I've seen a better shooter in any competition.
Yep.
And you know, on his file, he teaches himself. He watches on television, on video, and learns himself and goes out and does that.
Always a way, isn't there?
That's
fantastic. So it's but yeah, again, please do reach out if you feel like you could help. That would be fantastic. For obviously it'll help out the athletes and Julia as well, and we can put you in touch with some resources to help that along as well. I think that'd be fantastic. So one of the other things you've been working a little bit with is the Melbourne Boomers 3-on-3. So 3-on-3's hit our shores, you know, in a bit of a bang over the last year, I suppose, but no one's really invested a whole lot of time into it until probably this last 6 months, where NBL's picked it up a little bit. BA is doing a little bit of work with it now, and obviously you got your Melbourne Boomers crew, so sponsors of Melbourne Boomers, obviously Deakin University. But how did you get involved in that space?
Look, I think the 3-on-3 is just such an exciting space, and I think it look, the only thing that has that's similar to 5-on-5 is, I think that, you know, the court dimensions are painted and they're a bit similar. It's like a chessboard where you play drafts and chess on, and they're two different games. And I think you see different things from athletes in there as well. It's just really exciting. I suppose that's why I wanted to be involved in something that was quick, fast, physical, and we really haven't embraced it yet in this country. And we could see that it improving with each one of the events. Look, I was lucky. When you talk about coaching in here, coaching, managing, looking after a group of great athletes. So, you know, Mont Conti, well, what a cross between AFL football and basketball.
Mm, yep.
I had Maddie Garrick. I had Jess Simmons. I also had Ariel Thomas. Yep. Ezzy came on board and played for us, and Jess Shelley was on board. And I can tell you the first game they went out there, and I was just like, okay, you have to play for us virtually. Get out there and play. Oh, I reckon after one game that was like, whoa, we like this game. Yeah, and cool. It just picked up the ante with every game. And we were lucky because I knew nothing, next to nothing about this game. And I asked who knows the most about the game. And it was David Biwa. And I just rang him up, and his generosity was, come down here. So we trained with our opposition, with him, 6 a.m., two mornings a week, and we just learnt so much from that, and I learnt so much about the, you know, what was required with this game.
Yep.
But we did, you know, we did well out there. The girl, to me, the best part about this was that the girls really enjoyed it.
Yep.
So I think that they've, you know, they have bought into, this is a game worth investing. I think for us as the Deakin Melbourne Boomers, it was a real test for us. Deakin Melbourne Boomers always likes winning, so two runners up and a win, that meant that we were
at the good
reasonably
end of it.
Successful, and I was, you know, we brought home the first piece of plasticware to the club. So I think some of the benefits for 3-on-3, particularly at the junior level, is that kids learn to have to think about the game. It can't be coached, so you actually can do some coaching in your training, but the best training you can do after that is get them to problem solve, all right, and come up with a solution and the strategy of what you're going to do. Because when it comes to the game, like I'd say to the girls, okay, see, I'm going to go and enjoy myself back up here and watch the game because it's theirs. And one of the things, I suppose, the outcomes, because I said to them, well, look, I made them problem solve after the games. So what really worked for you?
Mm.
All right, because you need to do more of that. If that you think that worked. And they always wanted to jump in with what they didn't get right. And I said, no. Let's actually, we're wired that way. Let's think about what we got right. What would we improve next time? Because you've got to own it out there. So that was how the coaching went, any coaching went on off the court.
Yep.
But they coach themselves.
With 3-on-3, do you think they're moving forward? Because it will be a part of our space permanently.
Yeah.
Do we need to teach athletes a different skill set, or are we teaching them more so different tactics within the game?
I think there are some added skill sets in there. So the level of physicality is very different. And the level of physicality too is one where the referee will call it to the level of physicality the player's set on the court.
Interesting.
Now that's a totally different...
Yeah.
Different place to be, that if you both go out there and work hard at this, the referees will call to that level. And you've got players, you know, and we had one player that I think doesn't even get into the physicality of the game normally in a 5-on-5. So I thought it was really good for her to actually have to go into that game. And I think it's also that shooting, you've got to go to the arc to get the shot, and sometimes you've got to do that because you want to drive their plays in and out all the time to tire them out. So there's the strategy of thinking, how do we do this and why do we do this, as well as which is the best shot. Sometimes it's which is the strategic action to be able to play the game. And there's a lot of one-on-one, so that, I mean, if you watch it on television, the ability to be able to, the quick, fast, first step, and the ability to be able to fake really well in that space too. So I think with some of that, it actually illuminates those skills and amplifies them. So if we're running this with juniors, I think we start to do the things, particularly, you know, the under 12, under 14, which we would hope would be happening out there, but often gets, we get caught up in offenses and this, that and the other, rather than getting our players to be able to think about the game and actually get their hands on the ball. because if you only have two players that are going to shoot,
yeah.
Whoa, that's an easy game to defend.
That's Robbie's big thing, you know? With 3-on-3 at practice is if you've got nine kids in practice and you can play 3-on-3-on-3 and everyone's playing and everyone's got space and everyone can make plays and you got always going to have a chance to shoot it because there's only two other people on the floor. Yeah. Someone's got to shoot it.
You can't look that up.
It really is a great teaching tool. And you would think that if we do have more of it in under-12s and under-14s practices, that we will develop pretty good 3-on-3 players by the end of it all.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's something we spoke about a couple of weeks ago, and I think we just sort of made the off-the-cuff comment that how cool would it be if our VJBL competition was just a 3-on-3 competition instead?
Yeah.
Like, just in the half court where there is mass participation, you don't have any of the 5-on-5 concepts or structured presses or over-coaching. And, I mean, you hit a great point on that as well, Julia, that the play, you don't have you time to coach in the game. That thing is way too far. I mean,
well,
there's
rules. Well, it's not allowed.
No, you're not allowed to. Yeah. But it's too fast. Even if you wanted to coach, you probably couldn't. Yeah. Like, you have to make decisions on the fly, and you go from offense to defense so quickly, it's not funny.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you don't have the point guard that'll walk the ball up the floor, which will give you time to get back on D. That thing is go through the net, inbound it quickly, and straight back into play again. So I think the...
we spoke that VJBL, or under-12s, and not VJBL, around the country, we kind of spoke about... Imagine doing it at an under-12 level. And this was just a discussion we had in the office. Under-12 level, where now court space is an issue all around the country, but you can get these 3-on-3 games done in 30 minutes.
Yep.
You can play two ends. You can play two ends at once.
Yep.
You can then say they're 30-minute blocks instead, but you get four teams in, four teams out, instead of two teams in for 60 minutes. It's four teams in 30 minutes, and now all of a sudden court space is alleviating. Our kids aren't playing 9:40 games on a Friday night after a full week of school with school basketball Saturday or school sports Saturday morning. Like, it's interesting. It's a countrywide issue.
Absolutely. No question.
I think the other thing too is with learning, if you want to learn a skill, you need to practice it, you know, 800 to 1,000 times, like, and get your... I mean, I would tell students in my course that you have actually got to design your planning so that your kids get at least 200 touches of the ball in a game in your practice. So with this game here, they're getting those touches in the game and having to think through that. They're living the scenarios.
Absolutely. I love the idea of it. And I've watched a couple of games just online when they were streaming them, and I couldn't believe, like, I sort of watched the first time and I thought, oh, this is a bit gimmicky. We'll see how this looks. Watched the first game and thought, actually, it wasn't as bad as I thought it was. Watched the second game and I was like, okay, I'm in. Like, it took two games for me to sit there and go, actually, this is basketball. Like, it is still basketball, but it is kind of not basketball at the same time. It's a completely different skill set, completely different style. Like, I remember watching Gallup stick that three when they were overseas to get Australia the gold medal, and just thought, this is amazing. And the level of physical conditioning required to play, that is off the charts.
Yeah.
Like, it is not a game built for me by any means.
And
but
we're studying that. We're studying that at Deakin. We are actually doing some of the research on that.
Okay.
Yeah, just to understand the game a bit more.
They call that a segue in the business, Robbie, at Deakin.
That's not bad.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about your work at Deakin? So in the sport coaching, that's in the health faculty. You want to tell us a little bit about maybe how you started at Deakin and kind of your time there?
Oh, I've been at Deakin in sport coaching for this is my fourth year in that role. Look, I've always wanted to work at Deakin in this space because there's not many places around that actually run coaching programs. Mm. And we have a major in coaching, so students can come in into exercise science or sport development. They can do core units and then they can choose their majors. And the coaching one's really popular because that's where you learn all those other skills too. Coaching is nearly the glue, because regardless of what area you go into, you are going to have to coach people. And so for us, there are some things that are really fundamental to what we are always going to put in there, that importance of communication. So we're always going to work with our students. And it's interesting when they come in, because a lot of them don't have the only context they've got is that of being an athlete. They haven't been a coach as such. And actually standing up in front of their peers and having to present something is really quite confronting.
Mm.
So we need to give them lots of opportunities for those micro teachers and being able to teach skills. So initially for us, it's being able to communicate, being able to understand skills, being able to break them down, and of course that other skill of planning. And I think with experience, one of the things with planning is we get that temporal, we understand the timing of that, and we understand the timing, how it reflects the game. because it's not all, you know, go, go, go when you do a training. It should reflect the rest and recovery of what you would experience in a game. So that would be sort of where we would start with our students. Then the next level is advanced. So it's like we need them to understand long-term planning, not just session one, okay, session two. You actually have to look across the season and understand what that looks like to be able to coach. And, of course, issues in coaching. And we look at that really from, you know, ethical issues and from a sociological sort of lens, so that they, instead of the, just the pure sports science, they need to open up and see that that isn't always the answer, and that they need, if I always think, if I can teach my students to, when there's a problem, to suck in some air, take a step back, get the prefrontal cortex of their brain engaged, they're going to make a better decision, and even a better one if they say, come back in 24 hours.
I like that.
Because they can, start to think through it. So, and of course we have practicum units in there. So that's sort of our suite plus their sports science. But it's always a challenge, because in universities we're constrained by the time we have and the space we have. And I think with some of the coaching courses that are run from sports associations, you're constrained by similar things, but you've also got to look for really efficient ways of delivering coach education to the masses. And it's difficult because we have to... It's cognitive. Coaching is cognitive. You need time to think. You need time to invest in it. You need time to plan and test. You're a problem solver all the time. But it plays out in practice. And that's where I think I heard you use the word reflection before, that ability to always be able to, when things are finished, to go and revisit, look at what happened, what you'd change, what you'd repeat, and what resources you might need to make some of those actions happening. And, you know, good experienced coaches are having to do that all the time, because often it can be a lonely business. You're not necessarily going back into the group meet to discuss a problem. It sits with you or your critical friends, and you've got to sort of sort it out.
Yeah, for sure.
It's interesting. I was reading something the other day that the Philly 76ers, every, I think, 3 to 6 weeks, they have one of their players give a presentation to the group over breakfast. Or it's just, you can go and present on whatever you want to present on. Yeah. One of the assistant coaches will work with you to put the presentation together. It can be PowerPoint, it can be video, it can be whatever you want it to be. But it's just a way of, one, getting the guys to talk to each other a little bit, but also having the players become coaches and understand that, how do I deliver this message? Is it going to be able to be consumed by the audience as well? Yeah. And then can it be actioned? Like, it doesn't matter if they can understand it, but then go, yeah, I don't want to do any of that though. Well, have you got the desired outcome? And that'll change for everyone as well.
That's very smart, isn't it?
It is.
Getting them to go through a process that
I love that
actually teaches them what it is from both sides.
It is. And that's such a young group. And so for them, this is a little bit of leadership training as well, and that, hey, you need to put time into this presentation, because these are multi-million-dollar athletes. If you go up and you give a terrible presentation, you're going to hear about it, and your teammates are going to sit there and say, hey, you're not taking this with any value. I'm not going to pay attention to this. If you come in and you put time in, people are going to say, hey, they take this seriously.
Yeah.
Like, they're engaged in this. I like what they've got to say.
Yeah.
This might be something I'll follow up on them with. Maybe they've created a niche. And that can be from, hey, you know, this is what the Australian natural flora and fauna is, like for Ben Simmons, or that could be, you know, someone coming in and talking about, hey, the game Fortnite, here's how I play and here's why I play it, and it's totally different. Whatever means the most to them is what they go and present on.
I love that. And the change that's kind of, what makes that amazing now is that 25 years ago, when you would go on a road trip, you go on the bus and there's no such thing as a mobile phone. Like, you've got a book and your teammates, and that there's the environment, is you got to talk and you got to figure out who's, you know, who's got brothers and sisters, whose family is what, where you're from. And that was the one thing I learned, because when I was in the US, was everyone started to have a mobile phone, and the coaches that I ended up working with over there were really trying to figure out, how do we get these kids to understand each other the way we understood our teammates 20, 25 years ago. And that was what they were saying. We knew who's brothers and sisters, we knew names of family members, we knew all of that. And then we would ask the guys on the team, like, you know, what's such and such's family life look like? Doesn't know the brother or the sister, doesn't know the parents. And I think that's really, really important. And that kind of stuff there is critical in team building. Like, if you want to win, if you have not got that, you've got no chance.
Absolutely. Yeah. And like, we do it with our Seabull women at the moment as well. It was an initiative by our head coach. She said, look, I feel like we should have dinner together every Thursday night after mm-hmm. practice. And there's a few girls that travel a little way in to get there as well. So it was a bit of a, hey, let's put on something for them so they're not getting home at 11:30 trying to grab takeaway on the way through. It's like, hey, let's cook this up. We'll let them go. So the first night we did it, it was like there were no words spoken. Like everyone walked out after training, phones were out. Like we're now what, 12-ish rounds in. There is not a phone in sight.
Yeah,
like they eat and they just talk and they get to know each other and they understand that. And we've got girls that have represented Australia, New Zealand, some that have come through junior pathways that are different, and it's great to hear them actually talk about just their life.
And I think for the coach too, it's really important, because if you don't have and know other things about, and this is one of my lessons, I mean, I learned the hard way, if you don't know other things also about your players, you don't have a communication bridge that you can keep going when things go to, you know what. And that often happens. And what will happen with juniors is if you stop that communication, they just think you don't like them.
Yeah.
It's not about something happened here. And it's hard to get that back. But if you know that, you know, they got this dog and they got this, that and the other, when that one's repairing, you're still talking across this bridge to them. So I think that's important for coaches, but it's also important for players, because they can still have something else to talk about when someone didn't pass the pass to me when I was in the right position and they did it three times down the court, but I still like them because I like this about them.
Yeah,
absolutely. So in your role, so you've been in that role for 4 years, but you've obviously been coaching a lot longer than that. How have you seen the role of the coach change with teams? So it's probably a little bit archaic, that it was a little bit demonstrative at times, where there was the yelling coach that would just sit there and shout abuse and you have to do it my way. How has it changed to now, and where does it sort of go moving forwards, I suppose, from this point?
That's a really interesting question, because I'm not sure how much it's changed, really.
Okay.
All right, but I think our athletes have changed. I think athletes don't expect that someone just comes and it's right to just yell and scream at them all the time, and that they can ask questions if they don't understand. So I think that earlier stage of, you know, it's my way or the highway and I run a dictatorship and, you know, you're the taters and I'm the whatever, that was how it's run. So I think we've got some generational change, but what I know I like as a coach is the more analytical coach. The one that has decided that the best thing I can do for my players is be able to analyse the game and be able to give them the most important information that can make them the best that they can possibly be. And I think those coaches, then, if I'm looking at that in training, they're the coaches that are looking at the athlete and, once again, trying to problem solve. If we're going to improve, we actually need to... I need to solve that problem. Where is the athlete now? What's my knowledge so that I can look at, and what's the best way of me delivering this so that I can get this athlete to a place they couldn't get to by themselves? And I think it's the coach too that holistically understands that most of the time we're working with humans. Sometimes other coaches are also working with humans and animals. But, you know, that... people are the hardest things to work with.
Absolutely.
You know, it's so we got to really work hard at understanding people and working out what the best way is to get them to be. We can't motivate them; they have to motivate themselves. So, what do we have to do for that part of it? So, we got to know them really well, and making everybody sort of accountable, and that has to, you know, you have to agree to that, and that means you've got to engage in that part of it. So I look at a lot of coaches out there and look, I look at some coaches and I look at the parents and think, you really think that that is appropriate? And you wouldn't let your teacher, if your teacher behaved like that with your child, you'd be up at the school. This is also a learning environment, and you think that's okay? So I don't understand that at all.
That's interesting. I think looking at motivation like that, so that's a totally different... If you think about it the way Julie just put it, so looking at how do you cultivate self-motivation as opposed to you being the primary motivator. And I guess if you look at coaching and anything, like how do you build an environment where self-motivation becomes who your athletes are, instead of, which was the case, because we've all played in spite of a coach before. Like, you, and that's a dangerous place to live in. And it did work. And that was the AFL in the 70s. Like, that's just the way it was. And 80s, probably, 90s. But it's a dangerous space to live in. And if you can build an environment where self-motivation is the essence of how these athletes become motivated, because they can see something. And for some, it'll be the NBA, NBL. But for others, it's going to be becoming a better communicator, becoming a better athlete, becoming a better team, or whatever that is. And finding that is, that's where true coaching lies.
And there's something you touched on there, Julia. Get them to a place they can't get to by themselves. Like, that's really the key part of it as well. And you've got to allow the trial and error side of things, and players need to work out for themselves, okay, how far can I get myself? But then they also need to have a level of trust with the coach and be able to communicate to the coach that, hey, no matter what I do, I cannot make a foul shot at the moment. Can you help me with this? And they need to be comfortable enough to go to you with that and not feel like, well, I can't make a foul shot. I don't want to admit that to the coach, because then they'll view me as being weak and I can't do this, so you don't get to play. So the communication and the trust side of things is so vital with athletes, and especially junior athletes.
Absolutely.
Like, we are having a new generation of kids come through that are so more in touch with their feelings and their emotions and things like that. They can, you know, be so easily manipulated by the wrong coach that just treats them the incorrect way. And that's just such a big part of it as well. Like, you just need to be able to push the athletes forward, and that might be, and we spoke about with Justin Crowe, you need to have the athlete's best interests in mind, and you need to make sure that they know that you're in it with them, and you'll fail with them, but you're all in it together. Absolutely. Like, that is a big part of it.
I like that. Hey, you would have observed a lot of coaches over your career. Have you got a coach that sticks out in mind as the one that you were like, that's the best exponent of coaching I've seen?
Look, there's coaches I like for different reasons. Look, working with Ray Tomlinson, I liked because I think he was one of the best development coaches that I had the opportunity to work with, because he often took the team of all the leftovers and made them into a team. So to watch that, whether it was, you know, how he taught, he was a teacher, and he would do that. And then I think he was a very strategic court coach as well. So he could extract everything that was possible with a group that he had. So from that perspective, I like that. Alex Ferguson is someone that I really like as well, because I think he created cultures. And but he was also brave enough, and I think that came with experience, that there were some players that he couldn't take to the next level, and he graciously let them go, but he also celebrated in their success somewhere else. I think sometimes as coaches we want to grab on and hold those players, because that's, you know, they're us. So I think he is a coach that stands out there. And I look, you know, Pat Summitt was a great iconic coach, and you know, that's, it's one of the few flames that are up there for you know, females that want to see female coaches out there. She was out there too. So, yeah, different coaches for different things. And I think all of us read 1,000 coaches' books and try to pull something out. And but they'd be the main ones that I've actually got the 100-year-old Manchester United the book that is actually he signed for me. So that's one that's been buried
with
me, that one.
That's Sir great. Alex, Robbie. It's sir to you, Robbie. Thank
Sir
you.
Alex.
Ultimately, it's still soccer. So I appreciate the time he's put into the sport and the coaching, but it's just not really my sport. But that's okay.
Robbie's down on soccer at the moment.
I am.
So you're not worried about Optus. Okay. No, that's
well,
why.
Stay tuned. It's, I did unfortunately get Morocco in the work sweep, and that has not gone all that
that's
well
funny.
For me. It turns out. It has not gone well. So it's a lovely $5 donation back into the pool, and I'll stick with my Moroccan chicken, and that's pretty much where my affiliation with Morocco ends, unfortunately. Now, you did touch on it just briefly with Pat Summitt, but female coaching pathway. So you grew up in a time where there really wasn't a whole lot of coaching opportunity. You left the shores to go on and learn and come back and have developed that way. But why is it so important that we have a pathway for female coaches?
Well, look, it's more that I think that if you look at your daughters, you look at your sisters, you look at you know, your grandchild out there, you want to look at each of them and say, if that's their aspiration, that they want to be a coach, that they should have the same pathway. I'd actually like to take the gender coach off coaching.
Mm.
And typically, you know, the coach is it's white coach, 40 years to 45 year old, regardless of sport. That is the pattern we see. Now, if we can't see people like us in that pathway, it's hard to aspire to be something. And I use the metaphor of the maze. So with the maze, a young man can stand at the front of the maze who wants to coach, and there's lights in different parts of it, so he can work his way through because people have been there before. And in some cases, you know, maybe they've been a high performance athlete or whatever, someone gives them a sat nav that they can follow to get through very quickly. But I think for females, often you stand at the front of that maze and someone turns a light off on you.
Hmm.
And you've actually got to find your own way through there. And if you keep hitting dead ends, it's like you've got to be very motivated to keep going in that space. So we do need more role models in that area. And look, we have role models at the very high level, particularly in basketball, but I don't know where the other role models are in the space, because role models also need to be role models that are within reach. So we need them at all levels in the game, and we also need to look at those behaviors that we think are acceptable for coaching. So, and once again, sport has a short history, and team sports have a short history, and typically with coaching, those behaviors that have been acceptable are at the hypermasculinity end. All right, so the yelling, the screaming, even the body position of some male coaches at that end has been acceptable. So for a female, often, if they behave like a female, that's not acceptable for coaching. But if they behave at the other end, that's not becoming of a female. So it's this double-edged sword of how do I actually also behave in this space, and what is acceptable if I want to pursue that coaching pathway? So it's challenging because it's not illuminated.
Mm.
And I think although there's courses out there, how people actually navigate their way through is not explicit. You know, it's a hidden pathway that people accelerate through. People, mainly males, accelerate through. And we need to sit back and think about that. But having said that, all right, and I'm sitting here with two males in front of me, no one solved this problem. I mean, this is my research area. No one in the world has solved this problem. So we know what the problems and the issues are, but we are yet to find a good solution. So there's my other life's work, is to work in that space and see what we can do. And also, I saw that great, Basketball Victoria put out a great book on the pathways. And a couple of my friends read it and questioned it, and I went back and thought, no, the research is good. It's actually all right. But I think one of the problems often is for us is taking something like that into operation when you're actually working in clubs that are full of volunteers, and you need someone that takes hold of that, understands it, and can really run with it within your clubs.
No question. To start that happening. Yeah. We've got the Basketball Victoria Country Regional Conference on this weekend. I'm actually on a panel with Kelsey Griffin, Belinda Snell, and Tracy York. And part of my talk is about that coaching handbook as well. And I live this fairly regularly at the moment. I'm a male assistant coach with a female team, with a female head coach. And I'm lucky that my partner is the female head coach, so we get along fairly well, and I have great job security because of it. So I'm not getting sacked anytime soon, and nor am I trying to get her job, so it's really easy. But the amount of times we sat in a meeting where she'll make a comment and people will look at her and say, hey, you're just being really bitchy, or you're being confrontational.
Or what do you think?
Whereas I make the same comment and people go, hey, you're really forthright and clear on what he wants. And it's thinking, hang on, you haven't even realised what's happened here. Like, it's the exact same message, just coming from a different gender. This is where the problem lies. And I think there is a little bit of unconscious bias that comes with that. It's that people don't realise they're being this way until they're made aware of it. And I think you're exactly right. You do need a couple of people within that pathway to say, hey, it's been achievable for those people. I can go and do that as well. Yeah. And we need to do a better job of having people that are in the pathway be mentors for people coming through and showing them the way a little bit and giving them a little bit of opportunity to say, hey, come and get involved with this.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Like, I think the point of difference, male, female, doesn't matter. Sports is irrelevant. Communication is the absolute point of difference. Like, when I go out to ID players, I ID coaches too. Communication is the one thing that is a separator. So I think identifying good communicators is the first part to it. The basketball side, your athletes want to play for experts. That's fine. But you can teach expertise and you can grow in your content knowledge. That then becomes a case of, well, who's the best mentor for this person as they move through the pathway? Communication is not very easily taught. And there is an element of you're either a good communicator or a poor one. And you can get better at it, but it is very much you can talk in front of a group of 10 athletes and get the absolute most out of them. A lot of coaches will coach 20 years and in 20 years' time not be very good at it still. So I think that's an important thing in identifying coaches as well, like good communicators.
Yeah. And I was just going to talk on Guy Malloy.
Yeah.
He actually tapes every training session. And every game, he's mic'd up and he goes home and he studies his communication for clarity. And I would argue that communication is a taught skill.
Mm.
You actually have to learn it. You have to invest in it. It's a bit like basketball. I think that running, we assume our athletes can run. We assume that they can jump. We don't actually really teach that. And yet they are highly skilled activities that are so, you know what I mean? We need them for our game, but we don't invest in them. Communication is the same. We think because we open our mouth that something from here comes out here and it's okay.
Good. Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't. You got to practice it.
Well, and what may work with a communication cue for one athlete will not necessarily work for the next athlete either. You need to tap in a little bit and sort of find out, well, okay, what makes this player tick? And why does that work for them? Yeah, exactly. And you may need to push 600 of those 1,000 buttons in the right combination and in the right order just to get the desired result, and it's not that easy. And it takes time and it takes patience, and that's the hard part.
And the research would suggest with that communication too, that what good coaches do when they taped good coaches in practice, and I think it was in tennis and it was in golf, they were saying the same thing but differently. They were testing everything. So, will I do it this way? I'll say it this way. Trying to get through to the athlete in different ways. So the whole time you're in this test lab trying to clarify that communication. But I think you're right with sort of gone off topic here with mentoring and getting the right people in place.
Mm.
We need to find those people who are at that point.
Right.
At this point in time. And I think also looking at males who champion females, we cannot underestimate what that role is and how important that is, as well as good females that are able to do that. As Angela Merkel said, there is a special place in hell for women that don't help other women and pull them up through the ranks so we really have to do some work in that space, but I think it's a work. It's an ongoing piece of work, because I'm looking for someone that's getting it right.
Yep, and that's probably the hard part, is that we all search for it. We would love to get to a point where we have an entire female coaching staff coaching our female athletes. Like, that's with our state teams. We'd love to get to that point. But by the same token, we don't want to just throw someone in there for the sake of it and have them sink and not be up to it. And that's probably the other part, is that we've got to be really careful about how quickly we push some coaches through coaching pathways, because sometimes it can be the worst thing for them because their attitude adjusts or their skill level isn't quite there yet. And we just got to make sure that we have the right support networks around everyone that, okay, sometimes it'll work, sometimes it won't. But
that should be for any coach.
It should be. It? Absolutely, that's should be for every coach.
Thing, but we need to make sure that when that person sits, that they know that that is a pathway that they can take. And I would argue for coaches too, when you sit down and look down your bench, you need to look down your bench, because I'd say how many people out there have actually got a player that's actually made an Australian team? Not many of us.
Right.
You know, we don't actually, that group of 10 young kids sitting in front of us, when we look down there, we need to look with different eyes. You know, what we want is that they'll participate in sport for the rest of their life. That's great. Good health outcomes. There might be a couple, or might be one that goes further up. But you've got your administrators in there and you've got your coaches in there, and you've got to be having those conversations with, you know, these are the other roles you could be playing in sport. There's lots of roles in sport, not just me, the coach, using my chess pieces out on court to achieve an outcome that I think is important for those athletes.
That's very interesting right there, Robbie. I had a meeting the other day with a gentleman, and he said the same thing about football here in Melbourne, like TAC Cup football. Like, essentially the directive is that these athletes across the eight clubs, you know, 100 athletes at eight clubs, is to produce the next generation of local football coaches and local football club captains. That's the message from there. It's not about essentially saying we're going to produce hundreds and hundreds of AFL players. It's to leave the game in a position in 15, 20 years' time, when they're out of their admin roles or their leadership roles, where they know that the next set of coaches in the Yarra Rangers, the WRFL, wherever they are going to be able to then cultivate the next group of young athletes coming through. And I think that's really an outstanding point that guy made.
It is, and I had a very similar conversation with someone about stadium redevelopment, that, oh, you know, we're fighting for a new stadium. It'll never happen in my lifetime. But, you know, if I don't take up this fight now, my kids, you know, kids won't have anywhere to play when they come through. And it's a real sort of throwaway comment, I suppose, but unless you make the change now, like, you can't expect anyone else to do it as well. Like,
that's,
it's only
right,
what you can control and how you try and push that forward as well, which I think is of vital importance. And it can get lost at times. Like,
it's hard work.
It is. We all care about the scoreboard, and, you know, sometimes you take some ego hits along the way, but they're learning opportunities. Like,
yeah,
it's, no one's ever had a smooth sailing season. Like, you hear Steve Kerr talk about it. He just won an NBA championship, and he said it was the hardest year he's ever had to coach him. Like, and you sort of look at it and you go, geez, your roster's not bad.
Mm-hmm.
Could it have really been that hard? But how do we know what's going on?
That's right.
Like,
yeah,
there could be personal things going on with players, with himself, with everything. It's we don't know. But I think the big thing is, with any coach, build yourself a support network. And that is, go and ask questions of people. Go and tap into people that you feel like can help you, that have been there before, that have got experience, or that you just believe could be a really good mentor for you, that is happy to put time into you. And you can't force that relationship either. Like, if you're going to sit there and say, hey, I really want Mike Zeppel to be my mentor, you meet with Mike and go, actually, Mike's a bit of a jerk, I didn't really get along well with him. Maybe don't pursue that. Find someone that can actually help you out, that you get along with, and build that relationship with them as well.
And sometimes the problem there will be the courage to actually ask.
Yep.
And we have to take those risks. And what's the worst thing that can happen? Like, they can't take away your birthday. So you've just got to, you know, you've actually got to ask or speak to someone in your club and say, I'd like to work with someone and someone at this level, but, you know, I don't want to, you know, and there's just some people I know I don't want to work with.
Yep.
Any suggestion, or should I go to another club for that, or this, that and the other? But you actually have to ask, and I think that for females sometimes is difficult.
Yep.
Is the confidence to be able to ask that, I'd like to learn about this and do this, and I need some help with this.
Yep. I don't know too many people that would say no. You know, like, if a coach ever comes up and asks, hey, can you give me a hand with this? I don't know too many people that have ever said no.
Yeah, but you've got to step over the abyss first.
Correct.
And that's and I think with most coaches, it's when we step over the abyss with something that we get our big learning breakthrough.
Mm.
It's not the, you know, there's the everyday stuff, but it's when we have to actually scare ourselves a bit.
Yep. Put yourself out there a little bit. And
yeah, that your biggest learning happens.
You might fail, and that's okay.
Yeah,
like,
failing.
You just dust
yourself
off and jump back in.
That's it.
So probably the last thing I wanted to talk to you a little bit is the coaching networks and the family tree work that you've done. You gave a great presentation overseas on this as well, that I've heard back about, but in particular the Gaze family, and just the lineage that have come down and the learnings that have come down from Lindsay, I suppose,
mm-hmm.
in the first instance, and before him, sort of Ken Watson and Auburn College, and how it's developed basketball in Australia, and the amount of coaches that have come out of that coaching tree, I suppose, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, and look, you've probably just covered it all there.
I apologise, but that was very efficient.
That's all right. But this was just a study that really interested me, and it was because I was reading a lot about American coaches across a number of sports. And it's really obvious in this country that we can pinpoint where our basketball really got some momentum. And I mean, you are talking about both the Watsons, who just had this incredible, like, I think we look at the 1950s and it was a time of endeavour, and you got rewarded for endeavour and not asking for funds but putting up a good project. And the Watsons put, you know, they made a case for basketball in this country, and they were given a venue to work with. And look, I think Ken Watson was very, very smart with, you know, he tapped into the Gaze family, and selecting Lindsay, and I think directing Lindsay and what he should do with his study and getting him into basketball. But I think one of the big breakthroughs was it wasn't just basketball playing and basketball coaching, but he also got him into that side, which was all the administration. Now, because he was in that, we know with coaching, things happen like, well, I'm not going to follow that because this person said. But once you're in administration and responsible, you actually get a chance to spread through other avenues. So I think that was a really critical pathway for opening the door to what Lindsay had to offer everybody, not just those people that were in. We were even called the Auburn Tigers for a while, weren't we, before? Or there was the Auburn Tigers and the Melbourne Tigers. Yep. So he had those two pathways to work with. But there are so many players that came out of that then took on coaching roles. And I suppose it was my interest, having been mentored by Ray Tomlinson, that I could follow that lineage back to, you know, to Ray, back to Lindsay as such. And so I thought, well, how many players has he had, and what are we seeing with the number of coaches that are out there that would have come through the Melbourne Tigers that are now, that we still now see their fingerprints in the sport? Because we're probably now talking three or four generations down that we could trace, that we're that we still see the fingerprints of Lindsay Gaze in the style of play that is dominant within this country. So one of my jobs when I get some spare time, because I haven't finished the project, is I've interviewed Lindsay, I've interviewed Betty. I now need to really actually go to those next level coaches, and what I want to do, ask them too, is actually understand what they took out of the process. All right, because I need to see what their perceptions were and how they coached. So anyone that's out there that actually was, has come through the Lindsay Gaze school, particularly that first generation, second generation, maybe they could contact you.
Absolutely, more than happy to pass them on to you as well.
I'll be conducting some more interviews, just trying to understand what it is that we've got, because it's a really rich history for Victoria, but also Australia, because we influenced the rest of the country as well at those early stages.
Oh, no question. And when you look at the direct link, obviously, like Warwick Giddy, for example, played directly under Lindsay, played with Andrew. His son's coming through and daughter's coming through the program now that are in under 18s, but he's been coaching those teams in the juniors as well. Like, same deal. Like, they're going to impact so many levels down the line as well.
Some of them are still there. Like, absolutely. That first generation is still out there coaching, but we are seeing the other ones coming through. So I think it's a history that we should capture, and a lot of that history too is the capturing of it happened in an amazing stadium that I think also has a lot to answer for. You know, the Albert Park Stadium, it may have been really cold and really hot in the wrong seasons, but it was one of those places where you walked in and you could watch everyone training. And you said, oh, okay. And you could talk to everyone as you're going through, and you would be learning from each other. That was such a learning hub for anyone that was playing or coaching, and everyone was talking and sharing in that space.
I hear mostly, and I never had a chance to visit, but you hear of everyone was there. You had a great opportunity to talk and learn and teach, and athletes and coaches, and it was just that environment that was just conducive to what was going to happen.
And I suppose at least we got it at the start where it could spread. And I think that history is part of that Gaze Watson era as well, because they built the floor.
Yep.
And that's what we got there.
It's the toughest part of any basketball stadium build.
Yeah, that's where they spent their weekends, nailing in the floor. So I think we've got something to be very thankful for and very proud of with where we've started and where we are with our basketball as well.
Absolutely. Well, I think that pretty much wraps it up.
I've got one last question, Robbie.
No, you got more.
Just one last one. It's an easy one. I asked this of our better guests anyway, Julia. Have you got a definition of high performance?
Accountability.
Accountability.
Right, and you've got to set that up, and you've got to be accountable yourself, and you have to be able to explain what accountability is, and create an environment, once again, where athletes are prepared to motivate themselves to contribute in that one. So that would be how I would capture what high performance is, and hence high performance can be at any level as such.
Love it.
You can have a high performance under 12 team because of the environment that you have created and the learning environment that is there.
It's very good. Beautiful. I like that a lot. So just to reiterate a couple of things, anyone that's interested in being involved in a network coach with the Australian Boomerangs, please do reach out. And we can get some skill development into those athletes so that when Julia goes away, they are a fantastic juggernaut. Yes. And they will just go out of there with a very good coloured medal, is what we're going to leave that as. We'll keep that open-ended. And also anyone with some history on obviously the Gaze family and basketball in Victoria and just the coaching lineages that have come through that as well, please do reach out and we can put you in touch with Julia as well, and that would be fantastic from our end.
Awesome. Thanks for stopping by. Thank you very much. That was awesome.
That was fantastic.
Thank you. Oh, I love talking basketball.
I know. We'll get you back in another time down the road. But really do appreciate your time coming in. And good luck with everything.
Thank you.
No worries. So we've wrapped up with Dr. Julia Walsh. Another great chat. We've been really lucky to have some great guests. And Julia's obviously been one of the better ones we've had on here as well. But what were the things that you liked out of that chat?
Loved it, Robbie. Just so you know, mate, the prefrontal cortex is the front of the brain.
I'll be honest, I checked out a little bit during that part of the very valid, though.
Very good, very good. Mate, the best thing we can do is bring in people smarter than us, which is should be a common thing for us. The communication bridge, thought that was awesome. Yep. Like, what can you talk with your athletes about to get their attention? And it doesn't make it sound as if you're always wanting something. Like, if they just think that you want perfect closeouts every time, they're going to get sick of that and tune you out. So if you can find a way how to build that rapport, connect before practice, after practice, I think that really means something to your relationship with your athletes. And I just love the motivation stuff. So it's just a different way of looking at motivation. Like, how do you create an environment where your athletes are likely to become self-motivated? And that's interesting right there. If you think about it, that's maybe less about you being rah, rah, rah to spike motivation. But how do you intrinsically create that? Now, that takes a lot of time and a lot of effort, but I think that's an awesome way to look at it.
I love the knowing what she likes in coaches, which are analytical coaches. Like, it's really easy to get caught up in scoreboards, as we've spoken about before, but to analyze a game, and a little bit of that's gut feel, a little bit of that's learnt, but a lot of it is experience. Like, you've got to be able to analyze what's going on and then convey that, so it's back to the communication again to your players so they can buy in as well. I think it's really valuable. And when I touched on it when we were talking as well, but get players to a place they can't get to by themselves. Like, that's what you are as a coach. Your job is to improve players and make them better than when they first came to you. And so it's a great chat with Julia, and we obviously wish her all the best with her Australian Boomerangs team as
well. Absolutely.
It'll be great to hopefully get a couple of coaches involved with her as well.
Yeah, great opportunity.
It is. So last week we discussed rule changes in basketball and that can aid development. Mm-hmm. So Mike, I know you've done a little bit of work with your showcase this week. It's been picked up by a couple of other states from around the place as well.
Yeah, just some questions about kind of what we're looking to do, and essentially for them just to get some feedback on it as well, which will be really good to share. And I'm looking forward to the event, but also being able to kind of draw some conclusions from the event too, because it just might be a part of something that we're able to not only use as an event, but build into aspects of camps and teaching that we do on a grander scale. So we'll definitely see how it plays out.
Yep.
And we're going to get some, you know, some analytical, you know, scores and some statistics around that, but we'll film a bunch of the games as well, so we can kind of see in observation what does it look like.
Yeah, absolutely. So I did throw it out on Twitter last week as the pod dropped. what rule changes would people like to see in basketball? So
got some heat, Robbie.
Some traction. And it was one of the weekends where I was actually fairly slack. We had a doubleheader last weekend for Siebel, so I didn't pick up the phone a lot, but picked it up to see a heap of responses, which was fantastic as well. So a couple of the things that came in, and you know, we'll talk to this. These are obviously our opinions, not necessarily reflective of Basketball Victoria or anything like that, but these are just our opinions on the game. So a few people came in with the removal of full court presses for under 12 basketball, which was something we liked.
Interesting.
You know, we can sort of see the value in that from our end.
Yep.
A couple said they wanted the removal of the no zone rule in 12s and 14s. I don't know that we need to remove it so much as we maybe need to look at to adapt it. Like, it's if we can have a bridging of maybe those two styles of play, so no full court zone, no half court zone, I would have thought we'd get a fairly decent level of game out of that.
It's interesting. Shula and I have spoken about zone in junior basketball a bunch, and one of his ideas is playing a card, like having a zone card. I'm not sure if he spoke about it last week.
I think they do it in Queensland, where you're allowed to zone for a half or something like that.
Well, his kind of thought on it is start of the second quarter, you can show your card, play your card, and you can play zone for that next 8 minutes, which is interesting.
Yep, I like the idea. I mean, the no zone rule has been in for, I want to say, 4 or 5 years now, in which time it's probably a good time to start reviewing it and say, well, okay, has it achieved the desired outcomes? Do we need to look at something else? Do we adapt it? What do we do with it? So always a good discussion. Two of our BV employees, Steve Chalmers and Craig Freeman, want the removal of personal fouls in games.
That sounds that sounds really good.
This sounds like two guys that play hack domestic basketball that have just got a little bit of an axe to grind with some referees that have just said, hey, we need to remove these so I can play you longer and I get my value for money. I don't know about that one personally.
Billy would love that one.
Yeah, I'm not sure that one's going to get over the line. Had to bring back the jump ball in senior basketball.
Okay.
I don't mind that. Like, I like the possession arrow for juniors because it does speed it up when it's just a whole heap of jump balls, but I like the idea of removal of you know, the possession arrow for senior basketball. Fouls to stop the clock. So we're seeing a lot of unsportsmanlike fouls at the moment. So one of our listeners said the amount of free throws you get on those fouls is dependent on where the ball is. So if the ball is inside the 3-point line, you get 2 foul shots if that's a foul. If it's outside the 3-point, you get the 3rd foul shot for it. So that promotes a couple of things. Like, obviously, the offense will be trying to get the ball in and outside the 3-point line to get that extra bonus. Like, do teams say, we're going to deny that catch, which can potentially lead to a layup? Like, there's different sort of tactics that are involved. I actually quite like the idea because we are seeing a stack of unsportsmanlike fouls at the moment.
Interesting one.
A couple of guys sent in about they don't like the new travel rule. They want to go back to the old rule. To be honest, I haven't noticed this one all that much this year.
Yeah, I have not. And in watching the 18s Nationals in Geelong a couple of months back, I wouldn't say that there was a lot of travels called in regards to the new ruling. In Europe, there's still very much that dangerous to cross over step because if you pick that back foot up, definitely a travel. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah, I'm not too sure we'll see that one for another couple of years yet. Like, I tried to do a little bit of this stuff with my under-12s the other day and I got some quizzical looks from the kids and the parents. Like, what are you doing? You're teaching them to travel. I was like, well, actually, these are the new rules behind it. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Head out under 16 Vic Metro State Coach. Lowered rims for under-8s, under-12s, in regional basketball. I like the idea of this. This is one we touched on with the showcase.
Some lower baskets, Robbie.
Big fan of that. Mark Radford from down in Tassie. Size 5 basketball for under 12s.
Yeah, so I think that's a really interesting one right there. And you just think about hand size. And to be honest, we've got under 16 athletes that have pretty small hands. And to think that an under 12 athlete, and correct me if I'm wrong, a female athlete is playing with a size 6 in under 12 and our Olympians at the age of 26, 27, 28 play with a size 6. I just think in regard to development, and that's all this is predicated on, if they were able to shoot with a smaller ball for a little bit longer than what currently prescribed, that'd be interesting.
Yep, I think so too. I think that'd be a great adaption, especially for some venues that maybe can't lower the rims. I think that's at least a good midpoint. Like, smaller basketball would make sense. One of the other listeners said mobility between teams within the season. So this is more probably a competition issue, but I like the idea of this, especially say in a VJBL context. Big Air team's in October. And we can't change that team until the next October. So just the ability to change between, hey, you haven't been playing a whole lot, maybe go down and play in the second team or the third
team. Footy
style. Footy
style. Yeah.
Or reward the player that has been playing pretty well in the twos that's maybe developed a little bit too. So there's a lot of admin behind this, obviously.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because my mates that play footy and cricket just grow up getting promoted and dropped. And when I've spoke to them about how basketball operates, and they don't, there's no selection Thursday night or anything like that. They do think it's interesting that you could essentially just sit in the first team as the ninth or tenth player for the whole of the season, which is interesting.
And sometimes that hurts their development by being that ninth or tenth player if they can't move up as well. Like it's a really interesting point. Like I said, there's a whole heap of admin things that are around that, but I like the idea of it. It's something we can certainly explore too. So great to have the interaction on Twitter. I do apologise for not getting back to people a little bit quicker than what
Robbie,
I was.
You've got to get back to people.
I have at least replied to people as opposed to someone else that's in this room. So, again, if you do want to chat about anything that you hear on the pod, more than happy for you to email me, hashtag TalkingSplit on Twitter as well, and we can have a discussion from there.
Hey, NBA draft tomorrow, Robbie.
It is. I'm not getting drafted.
Well, commiserations to you, mate. Interesting. You look at the 60 kind of, everyone under the sun's got a mock draft these days, and you look at the 60 athletes that are projected to go tomorrow. And I saw a statistic this past week that 42% of the NBA this year was either drafted in the second round or was completely undrafted, which is a really high percentage. Like, I would not have guessed that it was 42%. No way. Which is interesting when you see these projections, you look at the 60 names, and it's like, well, who can actually stick in the league? Because there are stories over the last decade of guys taking 16, 17, 18, 19, just outside of the lottery, who essentially aren't in the league 2 or 3 years later. So interesting to see what's going to happen tomorrow.
And I was listening to another podcast during the week that was talking about how many of these guys in the draft can actually lead you to a championship.
Yeah, and I guess that's where I'm
thinking. There's not many. Like, at any given time, you look at the NBA at the moment, okay, LeBron can lead you there, no problems. Curry and Durant can lead you there, but they're both on the same team.
Mm-hmm.
Harden, unproven to this point, like whether he can get you there or not. There's really not many. So what you're looking to find is, are you going to find that transcendent player that is going to change the face of your franchise, or are you looking for just really good rotation players?
Absolutely. Like, and those workouts, like the summer workouts that they do, a lot of it's, you know, 3 or 4 player workouts, and there is an element of 2-on-2 that does go through there, but a lot of the time it's hard to test for you know, the heart, you know, who wants to, so a great quote, you know, who wants to play the third game in a 3-game road trip? Like, you got to find that player somehow. Like, where can you draft him? And they're talking about Jalen Brunson as, like, he's the guy that wants to play when no one else wants to play, which is a really interesting one. The other part is that we talk about small ball and the downsizing of the league, and you know, go through those mock projections, and like 7 of the top 9 guys are 6'9" and taller, and Doncic is listed at 6'8", so he's like right around the mark. But of those, there's like Trae Young and another guy who's 6'2" and shorter. Everyone else is 6'9" and taller. So the downsizing of the league is interesting. People will always still take sizable athletes.
No question. And you look at it, I mean, Draymond Green's a great example. Drafted in the second round, I think it was, from memory. Plays the small ball 5 for the Warriors, but he's still a dude that's like 6'10". Like, it's a little bit positionless too. So it's probably the skill set and the desire to win that matters, I think, in that. And a good Michigan State boy.
He is a good Michigan State boy. And so, it'll be interesting to see what goes on. They're just the listeners want to know about LeBron Watch, and I did get a couple phone calls out of New Orleans saying there will be some activity tomorrow, Robbie.
Is that right?
Have a look, for us to secure the services of the great man.
Yeah, okay. Someone's taken a pay cut, and I'm not sure who it is.
Hopefully, administration, Rob.
Yeah, probably not. Okay. Big thanks to Julia Walsh for jumping in again today. Best of luck to the great man Justin Schuler over in Argentina. I think they will have probably be pretty close to tipped off by the time we get back to the pod next week.
Yep.
Big thanks to all our listeners out there. Do appreciate the feedback that we get from you guys as well. And again, if you could like, share, rate, review the pod, that would be fantastic. Try and grow the audience. Good luck with your coaching, and we'll catch you guys
next week.